This is an AMI podcast. This is an AMI podcast.
Good morning. It's Wednesday, June the 16th, 2021. Welcome to Now with Dave Brown, coming to you on AMI Audio and AMI TV. I'm Dave Brown. Let's hit the horns and go! Coming up on the show today, podcast director Aussie Michelin describes telling our twisted histories, a new CBC podcast that reclaims Indigenous history. Community reporter Dorothy McNaughton will share a recap of the Canadian Accessible Election Town Hall. Mike Agarbo of The App Show discusses America's decision to revoke the Trump-era ban on TikTok and WeChat. And veteran political correspondent Craig Oliver is going to discuss the latest news in Canadian and American politics. We'll discuss Green Party leader Annamie Paul coming under fire, narrowly surviving a leadership review last evening. We'll talk about the NATO and G7 summits. We'll continue to discuss military misconduct in regards to several high-ranking officials continuing to find themselves embroiled in those controversies. And we'll touch on former U.S. President Donald Trump in Craig's segment as well. So that's going to be a busy segment and a busy show coming your way over the course of the next couple of hours. But let's begin with our top story of the day, an update on COVID-19 in Canada. Let's begin with the declining case numbers. Currently in Canada, there are 14,903 active cases of COVID-19. 25,972 people have died. Intergovernmental Affairs Minister Dominique Leblanc says Ottawa is in talks with the provinces and territories about creating some type of passport containing proof of vaccination against COVID-19. But Leblanc says the government may provide Canadians who want to travel sooner with an interim document to verify vaccinations.
The urgency of coming up with a secure, reliable, probably digital proof of vaccination is something that we're working on collaboratively with provinces. And there may have to be a transitional measure. For example, if there's a phased adjustment of border measures in July or later in August.
LeBlanc says Canadians can expect information within days on how the federal government intends to reopen the Canadian border to international travel, but he says a reopening will be phased in gradually. In a related story, the European Union will soon be accepting COVID-19 travel passes from international travelers. Tom Rivers explains.
The EU has developed a COVID travel app. From the 1st of July, it should be operational in all European member countries. European Commission President Ursula von der Leyen.
I am planning now to start my tour through 27 member states for the Next Generation EU, our Recovery and Resilience Plan, and I'm very curious to test and to see how this certificate will work.
The app will show whether a person has been vaccinated against the virus, has recently tested negative, or has recovered from the disease. Tom Rivers, ABC News at the Foreign Desk.
Coming back to Canada, Ontario's borders with Quebec and Manitoba fully reopened today. A provincial order restricting interprovincial travel between these provinces expired at midnight. The regulation was introduced in April as Ontario battled the third wave of COVID. It applies to land and water borders. Travel between the regions was limited to essential reasons such as healthcare, custody, or compassionate grounds like attending a funeral. It also allowed law enforcement to stop and question people about their reasons for entering Ontario. And in a related story, regional travel is set to resume between most of Atlantic Canada. 1 week from today, Nova Scotia, Prince Edward Island, and Newfoundland and Labrador have announced plans to lift their border restrictions, and New Brunswick is expected to announce its position later today. It means travelers will not have to isolate for 14 days when they enter a different province. Let's take a closer look at the vaccination story across the country, and we'll begin with the numbers. The provinces and territories administered nearly 447,000 doses of vaccine yesterday, over 29.9 million total doses of vaccine have been given, and over 33 million vaccines have been delivered, which means that 90.47% of supply has been used, and 14% of Canadians are now fully vaccinated. Quebec's Health Minister Christian Dubé is urging young people to get vaccinated to help the province avoid a potential fourth wave of COVID in the fall. Dubé says the presence of contagious variants and the restart of travel means the province needs to be ready for cases to rise again.
The one thing that we do control is really how we are vaccinated. So the more we are vaccinated, the more we are able to face whatever will happen.
Dubé says he's particularly concerned that about 1 in 3 Quebecers between the ages of 18 and 39 have not yet been vaccinated or made an appointment. He says the province will roll out more strategies to reach people in that age group. But in the meantime, he's urging young Quebecers to speak with their friends to encourage them to get the shots. Then looking south of the border, many American states are lifting pandemic restrictions, even as the U.S. COVID-19 death toll hits another milestone. Sagar Magani takes a closer look.
The pandemic's now killed more than 600,000 people in America, as tallied by Johns Hopkins University. Average daily virus deaths are now around 340, a tenth of January's peak. With more than 40% of Americans now fully vaccinated, more governors are dropping restrictions, like California's Gavin Newsom.
We are here, June 15th, to turn the page.
And Andrew Cuomo in New York.
We can now return to life as we know it.
New Yorkers will still have to wear masks in schools and on subways. Not so in Maryland, where Governor Larry Hogan says the state will not require masks anywhere. Sagar Magani, Washington.
Let's get to our daily polls. At AMI Audio is where you find us on Twitter. Accessible Media Inc. is where you track us down on Facebook. Yesterday, we asked you this question and got a lot of votes. So I was very happy to see how many of you got tickled by this question. So we discussed the Lotto Max jackpot of $70 million last night. And we asked you, is there a jackpot that will get you to go out and buy a lottery ticket? And 25% of you said over $10 million. 21% of you said over $35 million. 38% of you said over $65 million. And 16% of you said, I always buy a ticket. $1 million, $70 million. It's all more millions than I currently have. Fair. Fair point. Let's get to today's daily poll. At a time when there are endless cable channels, streaming services, podcasts, ebooks, audiobooks, and social media services, do you feel like there is less content that interests you? Now, obviously, you're listening to Now with Dave Brown, so at least this is keeping you busy for now. But do you find there's less content that interests you? Yes, no, or sometimes. So let's bring in Mike Ross first on this one. Mike, I know you're someone who enjoys a wide variety of content in your life, whether it's reading or whether it's social media, movies, sports, etc. But I'm curious, do you ever find yourself just kind of scrolling and saying, nothing's really popping off the screen for me today?
I do, but it's not because of a lack of content or lack of originality in the content. It's just so much.
Mm-hmm.
There's just so much to choose from. And if I don't know what mood I'm in, that's when it turns into 25 minutes of just scrolling. So it's great that there are so many people that put out recommendations to you, like through social media or whatever. And my wife's a great resource for that, because all those nights when I'm working hockey games, she's exploring Netflix and things like that.
She's curating.
And she finds other shows. And like now we've started watching one called Lupin. And it's dubbed into English, which I'm not a big fan of, but that's another story altogether. but it's something that I don't know if I would have necessarily sought out. And it's really good. So sometimes you need to lean on people around you a little bit for their advice as to what to look for.
Yeah, and certain folks definitely have the magic touch. But Mike,
sure,
I think you really touched on something there in regards to decision fatigue, right? It's like when you walk into the grocery store and you see 75 different kinds of butter and you're like, well, which butter best defines me? It sometimes makes you think like, okay, I'll just grab whatever. And
okay,
with some with content, it's a little bit more difficult
to do that. If you want
to
go with butter, that's fine.
I don't know.
I'm just tossing
random grocery staple into the mix.
I've never had a hard time deciding on what butter to buy.
What butter is
ice cream, chips, soda? many times.
But I think there is a decision fatigue, right? That you feel like there's a sense of regret if you don't keep scrolling. You might miss out on something that you otherwise would have watched.
And you know what happens almost 9 times out of 10? I end up watching an old movie that I've already seen.
Yeah, that definitely happens to me
comfort
a little bit
food
as well. Although I was scrolling last night, and something that Netflix does is if you hold your cursor over the piece of content long enough, if it's a newer piece of content, they'll play you a short scene from the movie. And I really like that because it gets to the crux of what's going on.
So Amazon does that too.
So I ended up watching this movie called Sorry to Bother You last night with Lakeith Stanfield, which started off as seemingly a very normal story about a young man trying to make ends meet in a difficult economy. And then it got weirder and weirder and weirder. And it was incredible. I could not look away. It was so, so good. So, you know, even those nights when you don't know you're going to land on something good, next thing you know, 2 hours of your life and you've watched something incredible.
So what you're saying is you picked the good butter last night.
I picked the good butter picked me last night, Mike. The butter picked me. Mike, you're filling in for Nazreen today, so stand by for that. But before we get to you on the weather, but I do want to get to a Daniel Penamondo to get your take on this. Because, Dan, you've talked before about how Netflix introduced that shuffle feature in your entertainment report. I know that you only have so much time as a man with a young family, but do you find that in this endless world of content, sometimes you find, man, there's not a lot that's interesting me
here? I know that the answer is no. Like, I like, just take a step back and look at all the stuff you have available to you. I like the smorgasbord of content that's available. Like, I have no issue with finding content. Usually if I sit down and my intention is to watch a show or a movie, I'm pretty good at, you know, picking something pretty quick. The thing is, life gets in the way, as you mentioned. Like, you grow up, you have different priorities. If I was 15 and living in the times we live in now with Netflix and all these apps, blah, 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 I would be glued to my TV 24/7 with the amount of content. You know, like, it's just the nature of growing up. You have, you know, naturally less time.
Is Daniel saying he's grown up?
Oh my gosh.
Is that what he's saying?
In certain ways, not in others.
Sunrise,
I'm not going to get into what ways those are, but yeah. Yeah, like, it's just insane the amount of content available. So I do not feel that there is less content.
Mm-hmm. Okay, well, that's good. I appreciate your perspective on that one, Daniel. We'll talk to you a little bit later in the show. At AMI Audio on Twitter is where you find us to vote on this, as is Accessible Media Inc. on Facebook. Let's go back to Mike Ross. He's filling in for Nazreen Abdel-Majid at the AMI Weather Desk.
Thank you, Dave. It's your National Weather Report from Environment Canada. Beginning in St. John's, we've got clouds. We've got some rain today, about 5 millimeters in total, and 15 degrees is the high. Halifax is next. A few showers in some spots, about 2 to 4 millimeters, but in some of the heaviest showered areas, it'll be up to 10 millimeters. Your high is 22, your humidex 27. Parts of the coast will feel like 16. Montreal, sunny and a high of 23. Ottawa, nation's capital, sunny and 22. On to Toronto, where it'll be sunny and 22 degrees. Thunder Bay, sunny today with a high of 24. Winnipeg, a little bit of a mixed bag, some sun, some clouds, maybe an afternoon thunderstorm, a high of 32, the humidex 35. Saskatoon, a mix of sun and cloud today, and your high is 24. Calgary, we'll see some clearing skies and a high of 20. Edmonton, some sun, a few clouds, and a high of 22. Mainly cloudy in Yellowknife today with a high of 17. And in Vancouver, it's been rainy of late, but it'll be clear today with a high of 21. Victoria, also going to see some clearing skies and a high of 20 degrees. And that was your national weather forecast from Environment Canada.
Thank you so much, Mike. Coming up next, podcast director Ozzie Michelin describes telling our twisted histories, a new CBC podcast that reclaims Indigenous history. This is Now with Dave Brown on AMI. Welcome back. It's Now with Dave Brown on AMI. Earlier this month, the CBC released a new podcast called Telling Our Twisted Histories. The 11-episode series reclaims Indigenous history by exploring 11 words, each of which have had their meanings twisted by centuries of colonization. Joining us now to tell you more is the podcast's director, Ozzie Michelin. Ozzie is an Inuk documentary filmmaker and award-winning journalist from Northwest River Labrador, and he joins us this morning via Skype. Hey, Ozzie, thanks so much for making time to be on the program today. We're so appreciative.
Yeah, thanks for having me.
So the podcast captures history in a very interesting manner, and that's through the use of words. Why did the creators behind the podcast want to discuss history through language?
Well, language is just in general. It's just how we imagine our relationships to each other, our connections to this land, and our histories. So we really wanted to just sort of show how different words impact Indigenous people differently and how these words have been twisted by colonization. And also, these are really large, kind of complicated conversations. So just having a word as a starting point is a great way to sort of dive in if you don't know where to begin.
We'll take a look at some specifics in a moment. But just broadly speaking, in terms of the podcast, who's hosting the show? And what are some of the words that folks are going to be learning about?
Yeah, so we have the amazing Ganya Dio Horn, who is hosting the podcast. She is the host for all 11 episodes. She's a Ganya Gahaga, also known as Mohawk, from the community of Ganawage, which is just across the Saint Laurent from Montreal. And some of the words that we looked at, the very first word we started with was discovery, because that's a good place to begin. And if you ever want to elicit a reaction out of Indigenous people by one word, discovery is a good place to start. Because if you say this to Indigenous people, they're going to roll their eyes, they're going to groan, they're going to say, nobody discovered us. We already knew we were here. You know, people made contact with us, but they didn't discover us. Mm. We already knew we were here. And then we moved on. The next word that we focused on after that, we looked at school, which is a very timely topic right now. It's a very divisive word for many Indigenous people because it's the source of one of our greatest pains, but it's also a way forward for our communities. And we don't dislike school, but we want to see school reimagined in a way that works for Indigenous people. And that's what a lot of people talked about in the school episode.
We actually have a clip here from one of the episodes with Ganya Dio Horn discussing family names is the name of the episode. So let's actually give that a quick listen.
Awesome.
Olivia Aiki Duncan from the Inuit community of Kujuak.
There's a story behind the name Aiki. My mother's grandfather was a translator for the Hudson's Bay Company who would travel with these white men as their translator because he was a poor boy. He would go on planes with them, and he always wore old clothing and clothing that was too small for him. And people in the community called him Aiki. In Inuktitut, I is the sleeve of a shirt. And to be ki is having a short sleeve. Aiki tolo, he has a short sleeve. So this is how they say we got our last name.
Aussie, something we talk about a lot here on the show is the way in which language frames conversation, that language is so critical. And we talk about identifying disability in particular ways. But this is a really interesting look at how family names have been a piece of colonization. So I'm curious how taking a look at this episode decolonizes the story of a family name.
Yeah, well, many folks, many Indigenous peoples didn't even have a concept of last name until European settlers came here. And it was European settlers that were like, well, there's too many Joshuas, so we need to find a family name. So we need to assign you family names, or we need to ask you, what do you want your family name to be? Oftentimes, they just went with the name of somebody's father. So in a way, but that to say that we don't, it's not that we dislike having last names or family names. It's just that the story of how we got them is a little bit twisted. So that, but now people are really, they identify with their family names. And for us in Indigenous communities, we use our family names as ways to know where each other is from, to connect with each other, to tell our relationships with the land, with each other. But we also talk in this episode about people who have reclaimed their names, about people who had generations ago, their family name was spelt wrong for some reason by a priest or somebody from the Hudson's Bay. So they were able to reclaim it and get the original spelling and pronunciation back. And we also talked to some people about the importance of giving their children Indigenous names as opposed to like European-style names, and just why that was important for them and what it means to them. So, you know, it just shows that there's a lot in our names, but some of it was not chosen by us, but some of it we are reclaiming and making our own.
How many different communities did you get to speak to over the course of working on this podcast, and who were some of the individuals that you ended up getting to spend some time with?
Yep. Well, we spoke with over 70 different Indigenous people from 10 First Nations and then Inuit as well, who are not First Nations, so 11 different groups altogether across the regions of Quebec, and then somebody from Labrador and a few people from New Brunswick as well. And we talked to all kinds of just regular people. And that's what I really like about this series, is that we don't talk to any experts. They're telling you how you should think. We just hear from regular people. Like, for example, we heard from Lisa Dutcher, who's a mother and grandmother. She's Wolastoqe, Maliseet is also known as, living in Fredericton. And she just kind of talked about her experiences and her views and, you know, why certain words, you know, how she reacts when she hears these words and how do they make her feel and how she would like these words to change or evolve or grow. And that's sort of what we heard from everybody. And I think that's why it's really important because it's really personal and just sort of feels like you're sitting around the table with people, you know, just kind of hearing what their perspective is. And it gives you a chance just to sit in and listen to what they're saying. And personally, I think that's some of the best ways to learn from people is to listen on their conversations amongst themselves. You know, the conversations that, you know, aren't directed at you specifically, but that are open for you to join in and listen. And that's one of the greatest ways, I think, to learn about anybody. So the podcast, I think, was really successful at that.
The podcast is also an incredible audio tapestry that sounds amazing. And it's unsurprising. There's talented people behind the podcast, so that makes sense to me. But one of the really neat decisions that you made is that when somebody was giving a quote in an Indigenous language, that quote was played out in real time and translated after the fact. Can you walk us through the editorial decision that went into that? Because it really added to the tapestry of the podcast.
Oh, thank you. We really wanted people to hear Indigenous voices, and we really wanted to hear them speaking as they naturally spoke. So if somebody was fluent in their language, we wanted to make sure that we were able to hear that and hear their voice being spoken. Because how often do you get to hear Inuamun on the national radio or on a podcast like this? So it was really just like a chance to hear and showcase something that doesn't normally get to be shown. And it's something that we were really proud of and that we're really happy that we got to share this with other people, but we're also really happy for all the folks who this is their first language and then they get to hear it in the podcast. So they can see themselves reflected back in it. And that made me so happy. And it's in the school episode, we hear two Inu elders speaking in Inuamun. And it's a language that I grew up around. It's not my language, but it's a language of like the neighboring community to where I'm from. And it just made me so happy to know that I was able to share this beautiful language with everybody. So yeah, it was a priority from the get-go.
And beyond the audio richness, even a lot of the graphic design around the podcast is incredible. The visual graphic for the podcast is gorgeous. It's designed by a Cree graphic artist, Sebastian Aubin. The image is a red with a black raven and a text that reads, "Telling Our Twisted Histories, Decolonize One Word at a Time." Can you describe why the choice of the raven was so meaningful here?
I'm not entirely sure of the artist's choice for it, but I can tell you that in all of our communities and all of our cultures, the raven is always present in our stories and in our lives, and also just physically in our community. We all have ravens and crows, and they're just sort of part of the scenery. But also in many Indigenous communities and cultures, there's all kinds of stories revolving around the raven, whether the raven is a trickster, whether the raven is a central figure, an antagonist. It's just really present. So, you know, it's sort of in a way, I could not say that we have just one bird that represents us, but it's one of the animals that I think a lot of Indigenous people feel connected to. I certainly do.
I want to jump into another one of the episodes, in particular the episode called Reserve, where one individual explains, while the word reserve is historically colonial, the meaning has evolved. So why do you think it's so important to look at the evolution of a word and have words reclaimed in these conversations?
Well, because it's already happening, you know, like we don't go and say, oh, the res, for the purpose of reclaiming it. We just sort of say it because that's what we say in our communities. You know, that's what people who live on the res refer to it as. So, yes, it has evolved, but we're just showing you the contemporary current usage of the word and just showing you how it's used in the communities. And I don't think that it was a purposeful action to reclaim the word. It just felt more natural and less formal. And when you say reserve, you kind of think of the government and funding and things attached to on reserve funding. But when you just say the res, it's casual, it's cool, it's the community. And I think it's really a community-driven word. And I think that it's really important to show the language and the words that Indigenous people are using right now, just to show how our language is just alive, like everybody else. Like when not just our Indigenous languages, but the English that we speak or the French that we speak, we have our own versions of it. And res is just one of those words.
And just coming back more generally, as I mentioned, I've really enjoyed the podcast. I think it was really well put together and really well done. If I'm not mistaken, this was your first time working as a writer and a director on a podcast. So I'm curious, what was that experience like versus working on sort of other forms of documentary? And what do you think's next for you now that you've had a chance to dabble in something new?
Well, let's see. I guess the podcast was, I'm a journalist by trade. It was different because I've never really made a series like this length, anything this long before. So it was really just, I had to stay very organized. We had over 20, 25 hours of interviews to keep track of in 11 different words. So it's just really like I just had to stay very organized and keep on track. And they after I listened to all the interviews, I organized them based on the words and then wrote the script around it. So it really just felt like, you know, sort of what I normally do, but 10, 11 times bigger. And what I have up next, well, I just finished making my first documentary film with the National Film Board called Evan's Drum. And it's going to be premiering this fall at different festivals around the country and then eventually coming out online for free on the NFB website. And I'm really excited for that. It's about the return of drum dancing to Labrador. And it's about, it came back maybe about 15 years ago. And it's a story about a mother who's teaching her son to drum dance and they learn how to make a drum together. And it's a really special short.
Sounds like a beautiful story. So when that drops, hopefully we get a chance to reconnect with you and we can have you on the show once again, Aussie. Thank you so much for making time to be with us today.
All right. Thank you very much.
That's Aussie Michelin, director of the new CBC podcast, Telling Our Twisted Histories. The podcast is available now on the CBC Listen app and everywhere podcasts are available. New episodes will be released weekly on Mondays until August the 2nd. Coming up next, we'll have Mike's big business story of the day. I'll have a couple of news stories for you as well. Busy time in the world of federal politics. But first, here is Canadian press reporter Karen Rebo with your morning business minutes.
Canada's main stock index set new records again yesterday on rising crude oil prices, including Western Canadian Select topping $58 a barrel to its highest level since 2014. Toronto's TSX index gained 73 points to another record high close of 20,231. New York's Dow Jones average dropped 94 points ahead of today's start of a two-day U.S. Federal Reserve meeting, and the Nasdaq tumbled 101. In Tokyo, this morning, the Nikkei index lost 150 points, and our dollar is trading overseas this morning at 82.11 cents U.S. StatsCan will let Canadians know this morning how fast consumer prices rose in May compared with the year ago, and experts are expecting another hot inflation figure for the second month in a row. Last month, StatsCan reported prices increased in April at the fastest annual rate in nearly a decade, 3.4%, fueled by a record year-over-year rise in gasoline prices and a rebound from rock-bottom prices at the start of the COVID-19 pandemic. From the Canadian Press Business Desk, I'm Karen Rebo.
Welcome back. It's Now with Dave Brown on AMI. We'll catch up with Mike Ross in just a moment for the big business story of the day, but I've got a couple of news stories to share with you from the world of Canadian politics. Canada's Prime Minister has checked into an Ottawa hotel in a final stop from his overseas trip to the UK and Belgium. It was his first international business trip in more than a year. Stephanie Taylor has more.
Leaving Belgium, Trudeau held an audience with the country's king at his palace-like official office. From there, the Prime Minister flew back to Canada and checked in at a three-star hotel in Ottawa to begin his hotel quarantine. Trudeau's office said he's following all the same COVID-19 rules expected of Canadians returning from international borders. Those who'd accompanied the Prime Minister on his trip were greeted by boxed lunches at the hotel and told to stay in their rooms until their negative tests returned. Stephanie Taylor, The Canadian Press, Ottawa.
And then a few stories from the halls of Parliament. Several outgoing members of Parliament are not mincing words as they move into the next stage of their careers. Nunavut NDP MP Mumalak Kakak told a special session last night that she found nothing honourable about her experience on Parliament Hill and has never felt like she belongs there.
Since being elected, I expect to be stopped by security at my workplace. I've had security jog after me down hallways, nearly put their hands on me and racial profile me as a member of parliament.
Kakak further reflects on her experience.
People don't like me don't belong here in the federal institution. I'm a human being who wants to use this institution to help people, but the reality is that this institution and the country has been created off the backs, trauma, and displacement of Indigenous people.
Bloc Québécois MP Simon Marcel also said Canada does not live up to its billing as a progressive, environmentally friendly and democratic country. Conservative MP David Sweet revealed during his farewell speech that he decided not to run again in his Ontario riding because he's been grappling with mental health challenges. The federal Conservatives say the military is falling apart under the leadership of Defence Minister Harjit Sajjan and are demanding Prime Minister Justin Trudeau fire him. Nicole Rice has more.
Opposition leader Aaron O'Toole says Sajjan's record as defense minister speaks for itself as he listed past controversies. Those include Sajjan having overstated his role in Canada's largest battle in Afghanistan and the failed prosecution of former Vice Admiral Mark Norman. The military's escalating sexual misconduct scandal is also on that list. Sajjan is firing back that the Liberals would not take any lessons from the Conservatives when it comes to the military. Nicole Reese, The Canadian Press.
And one more federal politics story for you. Federal lobbying Commissioner Nancy Bélanger says government agencies and officials were lobbied at a record high last year. She notes in her annual report that economic policy topped the list of most lobbied subjects for the first time since the commissioner's office began tracking in mid-2008.
And I think economic development is going to be at the top of the list for a long time yet. So I don't see the numbers necessarily dipping very much. I think we will continue to see a lot of lobbying.
Bélanger says video conferencing made it easier for lobbyists to connect with government officials, and she suggests the option may continue to be used post-pandemic. Let's bring in Mike Ross. He's here for the big business story of the day. Mike, who would have thought that a soccer tournament could impact the soft drink world?
Yeah, this is great. I sort of glossed over the story beyond the actual first reporting of Cristiano Ronaldo snubbing Coca-Cola. And then Daniel said this morning, did you see the stock price on Coca-Cola? And I said, what? So I did a little digging. So here's the story. At the Euro 2020 tournament, just as in most other sporting events, when players come out and do these news conferences, there is often a sponsored beverage on the table. Most of the time, it's water. In this case, though, there were a couple of bottles of Coke on the table in front of Ronaldo. And he is noted to be a bit of a health freak, of course.
You don't get quad muscles like that if you're crushing a bunch of soda pop.
Not so much. And so as he sat down, he picked up the bottles, shifted them away from him, and then held up a bottle of water and said,
no.
Agua. And basically saying that he preferred water instead of Coke. Well, Coca-Cola, one of the official sponsors of Euro 2020, then saw its share price drop from $56.10 to $55.22.
Oh, my gosh.
That's a 1.6% dip. And the market value of Coca-Cola went down by $4 billion because of that, from $242 to $238 billion. Now, Euro's spokespeople said players are, in fact, entitled to their drink preferences and have different tastes and needs. And let's be clear. I mean, Coca-Cola does make a water product.
They do.
Dasani.
Mm-hmm.
So to me, just a bad choice by whoever setting the table there that you should have all these products available.
Mm-hmm.
Put all the Coke products out there.
Get the Nest Tea out there. The Sprite out there.
Yeah. Now, unless there's, and I'm just looking, I have a photo here of Ronaldo at the news conference. I'm just looking at that backdrop where all the sponsors are listed on the wall, and I don't see any other water companies. So I think they probably could have put, there's Heineken back there. You could have put Heineken on the table. I don't know if he would have turned that down.
I mean, if it was a hockey player, they'd probably indulge in that after the game.
Yeah, but it'd have to be a Molson Canadian at
that
point, right?
That's true. Fair point.
NHL product or Bud Light, if it's the NHL. But in any event, the big number here, Dave, is a $4 billion shift because of a 4-inch shift by Ronaldo moving the Coke out of the way and proclaiming his preference for water.
1 billion per inch. You know, that's not bad on that front. Mike, you can really tell that it's a Euro walking around the neighborhoods here. People are hanging their flags, which is awesome.
On the cars as
well. On the cars, too. It's really great. I was walking home yesterday and walked by one house that had an Italian and a Portuguese flag out. You know, I mean, that speaks to the multiculturalism of Toronto. And then I went a little bit further down the block and I saw somebody had a Canadian flag and a South Korean flag out, which I don't think is related to Euro, but still cool to see. You know, like, put your flag out no matter what, because it's Copa America, too. So get those flags out there as well.
Yeah, absolutely. There are some households in this country that have hockey dividing lines, and certainly a lot of them have soccer dividing lines.
Absolutely. Hey, Mike, thank you for this.
Okay, Dave.
That's Mike Ross with the big business story of the day. I have your accessibility story roundup. Hee-haw. This one, not as much an accessibility story roundup as an inclusion story roundup. How Port Coquitlam is promoting diversity and inclusion through books at pop-up libraries. This was written in Tri-City News. Port Coquitlam is not untouched by terrible events in Canada and around the world that reflect bias and racism rather than understanding and collaboration. Every day, there is another news story that highlights divisions between people, but our new initiative is aiming to bridge those divides with books. This spring and summer, visitors to the Little Free Libraries will see brand new books among the shared items, with the titles representing the experiences of people from diverse backgrounds. The efforts to include stories by Canadians of Métis, Japanese, Syrian, and Jamaican heritage is a collaboration between the city of Port Coquitlam through its new Equity, Diversity, and Inclusion Roundtable and a local advocacy and education group. With the city's 15 Little Free Libraries growing in popularity in recent years, there was a natural starting point for the Read in Color initiative. Little Library stewards will be invited to sign a pledge as part of the Little Free Libraries Read in Color initiative, indicating their commitment to read and share diverse books. Book recommendations, a map of little libraries across the city, and information about how to donate books are posted at portcoquitlam.ca/littlelibrary. And some of the books available are going to include Requiem by Francis Itani, From the Ashes, My Story of Being Métis, Homeless and Finding My Way by Jesse Thistle, and Can You Hear Me Now by Selena Caesar-Chavanis, and The Boy on the Beach by Tima Curdy. So definitely a couple of cool initiatives there and a couple of important reads to get more books and more experiences into the eyes and ears of people all across the country. Speaking of getting content into your ears, a new episode of Kitchen Confession drops today. That's the Kitchen Confession podcast. Now, listen as host Mary Mammoliti speaks with Matt Bazile, founder of Fidel Gastros at the Mac and Cheese Festival in Milton, Ontario. Matt shares his experiences during the pandemic, evolving shutdowns and restrictions. And you can find Kitchen Confession on all major podcasting platforms. Just type in Kitchen Confession into the search bar. And there it is, right there at your fingertips to give it a listen on your favorite set of earbuds or loudspeaker, Bluetooth speaker, or even just through the speakers of your phone. We don't judge. Coming up next, Dorothy McNaughton, our community reporter in Sault Ste. Marie, Ontario, is going to share a recap of the Canadian Accessible Election Town Hall. This is Now with Dave Brown on AMI. Welcome back. It's Now with Dave Brown on AMI. Let's head into the depths of Ontario and catch up with our community reporter, Dorothy McNaughton. She's in Sault Ste. Marie, Ontario. Hey, good morning, Dorothy.
Good morning, Dave.
So, Dorothy, you wanted to take a couple moments to tell us about something neat to check out in the Sioux, and that's the Canadian Bush Plain Heritage Center. So tell us a bit more about the center, what it offers, and what's currently on exhibit there.
Oh, it's the neatest place to go and visit, especially for families. It's been around quite a few years. It's in an old Ministry of Natural Resources hangar down on the waterfront in Sault Ste. Marie. And what they did quite a few years ago was they started putting old bush planes in the hangar and fixing them up and then adding other ones to it and opening it up to the public. And they have neat interactive displays. They have a little theater where they show a movie about forest firefighting. It's really different, and it demonstrates how bush planes opened up the north.
And Dorothy, this is something that it's not just a personal point of fascination. It's something that you're personally connected to. Tell us a bit about your father and his relationship to bush planes.
Oh, yes. Boy, oh, boy. That brings back so many great memories. I was born in Sault Lookout. Actually, where we lived was on a lands and forest base. So there was a lake nearby where the bush planes landed. And my dad flew up and down the James Bay, Hudson Bay coast. He worked with First Nations people before the days of sort of economic development. Oh, my gosh. We used to hear the planes come in when we knew my dad was coming, and we ran down to the lake to meet the plane. And I just have so many wonderful memories of those days. And even after we moved down to Southern Ontario, he still flew in those planes because that was the only way to reach those remote First Nations communities.
Dorothy, expanding a little bit upon that, you mentioned that experience of growing up in Sioux Lookout and then spending some time in Southern Ontario and then coming back to the Sioux. What's that change been like to experience over the years, to see what was even just, you know, what, 50, 60 years ago, almost untouched land has gone through this development over the course of decades?
Yes, Sioux Lookout's grown larger. And, you know, having been in larger centers, Mississauga, for quite a few years before it was Mississauga, I love the north. I just love the bush. I love the wilderness. I love the people. And when I knew early, you know, that I wanted to come back to the north. So I've been in other communities in the north, in Cochrane, and then also we spent some time in Deep River. But the north is in my blood, and I think a lot of people who were born and raised in the north just love it and, you know, want to get back if they can.
So the Bush Plain Museum is expected to reopen soon, which is excellent news. So when folks that are making their way through the Sioux during the course of the summer, they can find it at 50 Pym Street in the Sioux. And of course, if folks want to learn more, they can give a phone call, 705-945-6242, or visit the website bushplain.com, and that'll give you all of that information about when the museum is scheduled to reopen once again. Hey, Dorothy, you also wanted to talk about some of the issues about reporting barriers in Sault Ste. Marie. You wanted to remind locals they do have the opportunity to report barriers they come across in the city of Sault Ste. Marie. So how can folks go about doing that?
Yes, I think I wanted to highlight this because I think a lot of people with disabilities, we face lots of barriers and often on a regular basis. You know, we don't know how to change that, how to fix things and make it better for us and for other people. So when the AODA came into force in Ontario, the Accessibility for Ontarians with Disabilities Act, they required the larger municipalities to form an accessibility advisory committee. And that's really where there should be recognition of the barriers that people face. So you can report that to the accessibility coordinator in Sault Ste. Marie, and then it goes to the AAC to be discussed and to look at possible solutions. It also gets put into the accessibility plan, which cities have to create every 5 years.
I don't mean to put you on the spot here, Dorothy, but have you gone through the process before? What's the process like of reporting a barrier that you encounter?
Well, actually, I served on the AAC for a couple of years.
Okay,
so I was able to bring it to them right there.
That makes it even easier. You're right there in the same room.
Exactly. And actually, that's one of the great reasons about, you know, trying to serve on these kinds of organizations. They have to have over 50% people with disabilities serving there. But I've talked to a lot of people in the Sioux who have faced various barriers, and I've sort of steered them in that direction to report it. And because if you just complain and nobody hears the real issues, the real barriers, then nothing's going to change.
Mm-hmm. Well, there is a point of contact here, which I'm going to share if folks do want to reach out to Nancy Scott, the city's accessibility coordinator. Her contact info is 705-541-2822 or an email, accessibility@cityssm.on.ca. There's also a fax number, but I'm not going to share the fax number. We'll put that up on the blog, ami.ca/now blog, ami.ca/now blog. So no worries about rewinding on the podcast a bunch of times here in rapid order or a run into the pen and paper, your smartphone. You can head over to our website after the show, ami.ca/now blog, ami.ca/now blog. And Dorothy, you also had a chance to recently attend the Canadian Accessible Election Town Hall, which was hosted by the Canadian Council of the Blind. So tell us a bit about the focus and what was discussed at this event.
Yes, it was really interesting because I've attended these in the past prior to federal elections, and you always learn something new. You learn what's available for people with disabilities during the upcoming election. Well, you know, needless to say, COVID-19 has influenced what happens in whatever election might be upcoming. So the person that represented Elections Canada was explaining that due to COVID-19, they've had to put a lot of precautions in place just in case. And so any accessibility features that they might have been looking at adding, like accessible voting machines. They're doing research into things like telephone voting and online voting, but none of that will be in place for the next federal election because of COVID-19 and the precautions they've had to take. So that was kind of disappointing.
Yeah. Dorothy, if you were to be making a wish list for how, if we put you in charge of Elections Canada, Dorothy McNaughton now in charge of Elections Canada, what's on your wish list? Because I think you touched on a couple interesting ones there. The concept of voting by web or voting by mail, even voting by phone, some more conveniences making it easier. But in your mind, what would you like to see in regards to voting being more accessible?
Oh, I think the electronic voting machines, which are used in a lot of provincial and municipal elections already. Mm. So, you know, unfortunately, they're usually only used at the returning office, sort of prior to election day. They aren't at every polling station during election day, unfortunately, but at least it's an option to vote independently. Mm-hmm. So I guess my number one wish is to put into place anything that will allow people to vote independently.
Yeah.
And the online voting, I think, is going to be huge for a lot of people, not just people with disabilities.
Yeah, just convenience through and through. For me, this one isn't necessarily about accessibility per se, but I've always said that it would be incredible if we sort of expanded advanced polling or even reframed the way we thought about election day and turned it into election week. So from like Sunday till Sunday, over the course of those 7 days, polls would be open so you could kind of vote on your own convenience. Maybe it doesn't need to be a week, but you get what I'm saying, right? That we're not just using a couple of advanced poll days in one election day, but we're creating a big, wide time swath for folks to get out and do their voting.
Yes, yes. And actually, you mentioned voting by mail. That is available now, voting by mail. And if there's still a pandemic and the election is called, there will be a lot of people voting by mail.
Mm-hmm. Which is certainly an experience they had in Newfoundland and Labrador earlier this year as they had their provincial election fall into chaos with a couple of COVID-19 outbreaks around Election Day. Hey, Dorothy, this sounds like it was a really interesting session. Where can people find out more information?
About Elections Canada and voting and making sure you're registered, all of that, it's on the website for Elections Canada, www.elections.ca.
Excellent. Elections.ca. And of course, we'll share that information as well on our blog after the show, ami.ca/now blog. Hey, Dorothy, always great to catch up with you. All the best to you. Enjoy some of this warm weather as it rolls into the Sioux. So enjoy a dip in the lake when you get the chance.
Okay, I'll do that.
That's Dorothy. Well, is it still too cold, Dorothy? Is it still too cold to take a dip in the lake? Are we still waiting a little bit for that one?
Oh, yes. And not only that, if it's Lake Superior, it's always cold.
It's always cold. Even if it's August, it's still cold on Lake Superior. Hey, Dorothy, all the best to you and the family.
Thanks. Same to you.
That's Dorothy McNaughton, our community reporter in Sault Ste. Marie, Ontario. And remember, you can always find more information on the stories we cover. Say it with me. We're going to say it together. Okay, you ready? 3, 2, 1. AMI.ca/now blog. AMI.ca/now blog. See, it's fun to participate and do things together. Let's wrap up the hour by sharing a couple of news stories. A spokesperson for Russian President Vladimir Putin cautioned that Putin's talks with U.S. President Joe Biden today in Geneva will, quote, not be easy or likely yield any breakthroughs. Julie Walker has more.
Putin's spokesman Dmitry Peskov says the topics on the broad agenda are mostly problematic. Quote, we have many long-neglected questions that need to be trawled through. That's why President Putin is arriving with an attitude to frankly and constructively set questions and try to find solutions. He went on to say this day cannot become historic and we shouldn't expect any breakthroughs. The situation is too difficult in Russian-American relations. Peskov says the bilateral issues Putin wants to discuss include strategic stability, arms control, cooperation in regional conflicts and on the pandemic, and climate change. I'm Julie Walker.
And just as we were hitting the airwaves today, President Joe Biden had arrived at that summit in Geneva, as well as President Vladimir Putin. So those conversations are going to be going on throughout the day. And I suspect that we'll have some sound to play for you tomorrow at some of the press conferences after the fact. So looking forward to sharing some of that one. And we're also going to be talking a little bit about American relations, Russian relations and Chinese relations with Craig Oliver in about 45 minutes time during his segment. in regards to politics with Craig Oliver. Got one more story to share with you here. China is disputing accusations of human rights and economic abuses leveled by G7 leaders. Inez de la Couture has those details.
Chinese Foreign Ministry spokesperson Zhao Lijian saying the joint G7 statement deliberately slanders China on several issues related to Hong Kong, Xinjiang, and Taiwan, and that it interferes in China's internal affairs. Zhao saying, quote, it reveals the malign intentions of the U.S. and a few other countries to create confrontations and widen differences and disputes. China is strongly dissatisfied with and firmly opposed to this, and adding, quote, the era of one country or a block of countries dictating world affairs is over. Inez de la Quatera, ABC News, at the Foreign Desk.
Yeah, there's lots to discuss in the world of politics when Craig joins us. I said 45 minutes. It's actually going to be a little bit closer to 40 minutes when Craig hops on with us to discuss what's going on in the world of politics for his Politics and Perspective segment. So you'll want to make sure you stay tuned for that one. Of course, it's domestic, it's foreign, there's a lot of stuff going on. And with the NATO and G7 summits that went on this week as well, Craig's got lots of thoughts on what's going on there as well. But I know you have thoughts, right? This isn't just me talking at you, I'm talking to you. And what does that mean when we're having a conversation together? That means you get to talk back to me. So use the channels that we have available to you to share your thoughts on the topics we discuss or the show in general. Send us emails, feedback@ami.ca. feedback@ami.ca is where you send us an email. You can also find us on Twitter @AMI Audio, @AMI Audio on Twitter. Accessible Media Inc. is where you find us on Facebook. That's where you can share some feedback and follow the work that we do on the shows, but also vote on things like our daily polls, which we appreciate it when you do. But what I love is when you pick up the phone, you show a little of that little gumption and initiative. You pick up the phone and you give us a phone call, 1-866-509-4545. That's 1-866-509-4545. Actually, do you want to participate again? We can do something together. Look, let's pick up our smartphones together, right? We'll open it and unlock it with my thumbprints, which I still find really annoying. I wish I could just swipe my phone open, but no. Now, for security reasons, you have to have your phone locked by a thumbprint. Okay, let's type in the number together and put it in our speed dial. 1-866-509-4545. Look, I did it on my phone right there. I'm not yanking your chain. If you do leave us a message, please give us permission to play it on the air. This is Now with Dave Brown on AMI. Welcome back. It's Now with Dave Brown on AMI. It's Wednesday, June the 16th, 2021. Coming up in the second hour of the show, Mike Agarbo of The App Show is going to discuss America's decision to revoke the Trump-era ban on TikTok and WeChat. And we'll get some political analysis from Craig Oliver as he takes a closer look at what's going on in the world of Canadian and American politics, as well as international politics with NATO and the G7, as well as the Biden-Putin summit that's occurring today. And of course, we'll also be discussing what's going on with Green Party leader Annamie Paul, who narrowly survived a leadership review last night with some infighting going on in that party. So lots to get to with Craig Oliver in a couple minutes' time. But for now, let's bring in Mike Ross and the regional news update.
Thanks, Dave. We'll begin in British Columbia, where the province's ombudsperson says BC's use of solitary confinement among youth inmates is disturbing, and the province needs to change its practices to follow international standards. A 3-year investigation by Jay Chalk concludes the provincial government's use of solitary confinement for jailed youth is unjust and unsafe. He says it's inconsistent with the youth justice legislation, international norms and conventions, and the recent Canadian court decisions, which found the analogous, a practice in adults in corrections to be unconstitutional. Chalk, whose office investigates complaints against provincial and local authorities, says the confinement disproportionately impacts Indigenous youth, particularly First Nation females. To the territories, and Yukon health officials are scheduled to give an update on COVID-19 at 10:30 a.m. today as the territory reports 12 new cases. The territory's acting chief medical officer of health, Dr. Catherine Elliott, says the people infected are between the ages of 10 and 40. She says all the cases are linked to a White Horse contact, and only one among them was recently vaccinated. The territory now has 33 active cases. To the Prairies and the rural municipality of Gimli, Manitoba, about 82 kilometers of Winnipeg, is considering to change four local roads and their names that have ties to colonialism. The roads are Colonization Road, Arns, North Colonization Road, South Colonization Road, and it's a bit of a tongue twister.
It's a lot of colonization.
It is a lot of colonization. Colonization Close. The roads were at one time a single route, but as communities expanded and the land use changed, it was broken up into sections. Mayor Lynn Greenberg says it's been raised before, but in light of the recent discovery of what is believed to be the remains of 215 Indigenous children near a Kamloops residential school, the issue has once again gained traction. To Ontario, the province announcing they're going to spend $10 million to help identify residential school burial sites. The money, spread over 3 years, will also fund investigations and commemorations. The province says the funds will also provide supports for survivors and their families, and says the process will be Indigenous-led. And in the Atlantic region, three out of four Atlantic provinces say they will lift border restrictions and open to travel from across the region beginning next week. Nova Scotia, Prince Edward Island, and Newfoundland and Labrador say a June 23rd reopening is possible because of steadily declining COVID-19 rates across the region. The move means travelers won't have to isolate for 14 days upon entering each province. New Brunswick is now open to PEI and Newfoundland and Labrador. And Premier Blaine Higgs says with his province moving so quickly towards its vaccination goals, border restrictions to Nova Scotia could be lifted before the end of this week. And those are your top regional headlines going coast to coast across the country.
Thank you very much, Mike. We'll talk to you a little bit later in the hour to find out what happened this day in history, the now of then. But let's bring in Jeff Ryman and have ourselves a sports chat. Jeff, for sports fans, it's a time of gluttony. Endless sports to consume. Canada qualifying to the next stage of World Cup qualifying last night. Euro soccer, Copa America soccer, NHL playoffs, NBA playoffs, MLB regular season, tennis tournaments. It's nonstop. It's nonstop, Jeff. But we have to drill down and just pick a couple of things to talk about today. Let's start with the Montreal Canadiens and Vegas Golden Knights renewing acquaintances tonight for game two of their NHL Stanley Cup semifinal series. Jeff, I don't know how much ground there is to cover here because game one really played out as we expected.
Pretty much as we expected. You're right, Dave. And so I think Montreal needs to head back to the drawing board just a little bit. Of course, I mean, whenever you lose the first game, you kind of want to, you know, re-tinker with a couple of different things. And I have two things I think Montreal should do is one, not panic, Dave. They've got that experience factor, and we talked about that for a reason. A lot of teams at this point in the playoffs, they might start to be like, ooh, you know, we're down 1-0. We're in hostile territory still. You can't come out nervous. You can't come out anxious. Just look at the Tampa Bay Lightning yesterday. Calm, cool, collected. They changed their game style a little bit, and that obviously boded well for them as they got the win yesterday. And
it's a little bit different, though. It's a little bit different. It's easier not to panic when it's Nikita Kucherov and Steven Stamkos and Braden Point and Victor Hedman and Andrei Vasilevsky versus, say, like Tyler Toffoli and you know, Joel Edmonston.
Dave, I'm trying to pump your tires a little bit here.
I appreciate it. I appreciate
it. Montreal Canadiens. I guess, yes, easier said than done, especially with a team like Montreal going up against a juggernaut in Vegas. And the second thing is just reestablish that forecheck. You mentioned it yesterday, Dave. The first 10, 15 minutes, they were able to keep up with Vegas. And then after that, they just tailed right off. And they were not able to establish a forecheck after that. So, that's their bread and butter. That's where they make their money.
Mm-hmm.
And they were not able to do that. So they're going to have to do those two things, I think, if they have any chance of competing with Vegas. And of course, they need stellar goaltending, but that's never really been in doubt at all during the playoffs. So easier said than done for Montreal, but it'll be fun to watch.
So fair to note one thing here, and this is not groundbreaking analysis from me here either. For Montreal, the key is to get the lead. when they have had the lead in a playoff series, when they've scored first in a playoff series or a playoff game, they're 8-0. When they've trailed, they're 0-4. Montreal is not talented enough to chase the game. They cannot chase a score. They cannot fall down by a couple of goals. They need to take the lead and clog the zone. So that's some pretty basic analysis from Dave. Give me a job. Give me a job, TSN. I'm clearly ready to be on your panel. Jeff, let's switch gears here a little bit. Something that we have not talked about a lot pretty much throughout the year due to the Raptors' struggles and just generally the NBA playoffs have been a little bit of an afterthought. There's a really good series unfolding for us here in the Eastern Conference between the Atlanta Hawks and Philadelphia 76ers. That game is going to be on TSN tonight. And this is one that I think people should be checking out for a lot of the new blood that we've been talking about in the NBA playoffs. There are a couple players here that are the new blood.
Seth Curry, is that who you're talking about here, Dave?
But you know, I like your sarcasm there. But you know, people are probably familiar with the name Joel Embiid, Ben Simmons, Trae Young. These are names that have probably even come across the casual fans' ears, but they haven't necessarily had a chance to be in the spotlight. So this has been a great opportunity to watch a couple of young-ish players start to make their mark in the league.
Yeah, Trae Young's been on another level. Joel Embiid up and down. Last game shot 4-for-20 from the field, although he was injured. And I think he's dealing with that right knee injury he sustained in the first round.
A minor torn meniscus. It's easy to say it's minor when it's somebody else's meniscus.
And when you're 7 feet and almost 300 pounds, you know, that's probably going to bother you just a little bit as you head deeper into the playoffs. So that's another storyline to watch. Joel Embiid, who was, second in MVP votes, third in MVP votes throughout the regular season, had a phenomenal year. But we really saw it. If Joel Embiid is not on and not able to play at 100%, it really starts to bog down the Philadelphia 76ers. Then on the flip side, you can't really let your foot off the pedal because they got guys like Trae Young, who has just been lights out throughout this entire series. So we're starting to see that new blood, Dave, and it's honestly kind of refreshing. So hopefully the injuries don't get the better of both these teams, and that's kind of been another storyline of the playoffs, Dave. I'm just looking right now. Kawhi Leonard expected to maybe miss the remainder of the series with a right knee injury.
Oh,
so
wow.
Yet another injury to a star player. And Chris Paul also is now in health and safety protocols. His team is awaiting another team for the matchup in the Western Finals, but still not ideal news for the Phoenix Suns. And you can just add that to LeBron James, who was injured in the first round, Anthony Davis, Kyrie Irving, James Harden, Joel Embiid, Kawhi Leonard, Chris Paul now. The list goes on. But hopefully we get some good basketball, and hopefully we do see some of that new young blood come to fruition now.
Well, Jeff, thank you for this. We always appreciate catching up with you and chatting a little bit of sports. Enjoy all the action today, and we'll talk to you tomorrow.
See you, Dave.
That's Jeff Ryman. He is at the AMI Sports Desk. Again, a couple of sporting events that you want to check out tonight, starting at 7:30 p.m. Eastern Time when the Atlanta Hawks visit the Philadelphia 76ers. Oh, I thought this game was going to be on TSN. Turns out, Sportsnet 360. Oh, and then, of course, 9 p.m. Eastern Time, the Vegas Golden Knights and Montreal Canadiens. That game is going to be on Sportsnet and CBC. Let's bring in Mike Ross. He's at the AMI Weather Desk.
Thanks again, Dave. We're going to begin in Corner Brook, Newfoundland, with your national weather forecast from Environment Canada. It'll be cloudy today, about 5 millimeters of rain in total coming your way, and a high of 16 degrees. Charlottetown, showers ending near the early afternoon. You're getting between 2 and 4 millimeters, your high 23, your humidex 28. St. John, New Brunswick, some drizzle, some showers, but it'll end late in the day. Your high is 19. Quebec City, sunny with some clouds rolling in later on through the day, a risk of a thunderstorm and a high of 20 degrees. Toronto, sunny and 22. Sault Ste. Marie, Ontario will be sunny and 19 degrees. Off to Brandon, Manitoba. You've got a risk of a thunderstorm and a high of 32 today. The humidex should hit 35. Regina, that's where we're going next. Regina, Saskatchewan, sunny today with a high of 25. Lethbridge, Alberta will be sunny today with a high of 23. It'll be sunny with some clouds in Red Deer, Alberta. Risk of a thunderstorm and a high of 21. Off to Whitehorse, where it'll be mainly sunny and 13 today. Kelowna, BC, sunny with a high of 24. And Vancouver, British Columbia, clearing skies today. They've had a lot of rain lately, so nice there with a high of 21. And that is your national weather forecast from Environment Canada.
Thank you very much, Mike. Coming up next, Mike Agarbo of The App Show will discuss America's decision to revoke the Trump-era ban on TikTok and WeChat. But first, ride-sharing prices are on the rise. Here's Alex Stone with Tech Trends.
E-commerce company Rakuten estimates rideshare pricing spiked 40% in recent months. The company's VP of Data and Analytics, Dave Gill, says if you live in a big city like New York, LA, or Chicago, that number could double.
New York City restaurants opened up and grocery stores and people are going out to retail, you know, enjoying behaviors that they used to. That created a really strong surge in demand, and there just weren't the drivers to keep up with that demand, and so that's when you see the high prices.
Harry Campbell, founder of the blog The Rideshare Guy, says drivers have also been gravitating to other jobs in the gig economy.
So you saw a lot of people switch from rideshare over to delivery, and not only did they switch, but they actually maybe earned more money.
Last week, Uber announced it's creating a $250 million driver stimulus designed to bring drivers back to the company. With Tech Trends, I'm Alex Stone, ABC News.
Welcome back. It's Now with Dave Brown on AMI. Let's talk tech with Mike Agarbo of The App Show. And of course, you can hear The App Show Saturdays at 4 p.m. Eastern Time on AMI Audio. And Mike joins us this morning from Vancouver, BC. Hey, good morning, Mike.
Good morning.
So, Mike, let's start in the United States, where U.S. President Joe Biden signed an executive order last week revoking the Trump-era bans on TikTok and WeChat. So just to refresh everyone's memory here, could you tell us about the former president's executive orders that were blocking these apps from American app stores?
Yeah, basically, during the Trump era, he tried to institute a ban on those three apps, which are typically, Chinese. There was a lot of Chinese folks using it, obviously, over in China, but many, many people here in North America as well. But essentially, that got caught up in a bunch of different court battles and wasn't really fully implemented. There was even talk of, companies buying TikTok, including Oracle, but that never came to fruition either.
So why did President Biden decide to revoke the previous executive order?
I guess they thought it wasn't a good order. They're still concerned about foreign governments like China and military governments owning bits of these types of companies, especially when it comes to communication companies like WeChat and also the fact that they also do transactions. So he wants to have an open and fair internet. But at the same time, he is having federal investigators look into these apps a little bit further.
Right. So what is he doing in the place there? Tell us a bit more about the actions that he wants to take in regards to still be perhaps a little bit of a placeholder of what Trump's orders were.
Yeah, basically, these investigators are going to see, how much the foreign governments, have influence in these particular apps. Essentially, a lot of Americans are using them. And, it looks like they do feel it could be a national security threat, if any of this information is going back to, the Chinese government and they, could use it in nefarious ways, essentially.
Let's cross the border back into Canada, where Canada's Federal Privacy Commissioner concluded last week that the RCMP broke privacy law using Clearview, a controversial artificial intelligence facial recognition software that put innocent citizens in what the commissioner described as a 24/7 police lineup. So, Mike, what exactly did the RCMP do in breaching people's privacy?
Well, this company basically scraped the internet, capturing literally billions of people's photos off of their social media accounts that, basically open to the public. And they created this database and sold that to law enforcement agencies around the world to be able to use it to do facial recognition matches of potential criminal suspects, essentially. So what the privacy commissioner found was that this was against the law because these images were obtained illegally here in Canada. Apparently, the RCMP or a few different detachments did use it a bit. Apparently, it wasn't widespread, but they haven't been using it since there was a bit of a dust-up about it.
Do we have a sense of how long this action was taking place, how long this scraping of the web was taking place and these resources were being used?
Clearview, I think, is still to this day scraping the internet for images. And there are a lot of law enforcement agencies around the world using the database of these faces. So it's still happening. But here in Canada, again, the Privacy Commissioner has deemed it illegal. So you're not going to find any law enforcement agencies here using it anymore.
Has the RCMP made any statements in response to the report?
I think they did say that a few of their agencies did use it, but they are no longer using it going forward here.
So staying in this theme, but now looking across the ocean, privacy activists in five European countries recently lodged data protection complaints against Clearview. What does Clearview have to say about the privacy complaints lodged against them?
I mean, basically, they're saying that they'll, work with the different countries to make sure that they're not breaking the law. So, they are pulling out of the countries essentially that they are running afoul of, those local laws. But, overall, they don't believe they are breaching the law because these images are available publicly.
Mm. Mike, it's almost impossible when we talk about technology not to discuss Apple. So at a recent developers conference, the tech giant revealed that its Apple Wallet app will soon be able to work as a key for your car, a home, and maybe even a piece of identification in the future. But Mike, before we get into these new developments, someone like me who's not an Apple user needs a reminder. How does the Apple Wallet app work?
It's basically a secure place on the phone where you can store important documents. For Apple, for example, and Google's done this too with Google Pay, essentially you can put your credit cards and debit cards in there electronically or digitally, and then use your phone as a contactless payment device, when you go to Walmart or wherever, for example, to pay for your groceries. So they say it's more secure than actually having the physical cards themselves. They don't ever own any of the credit card numbers or anything. And every time you do make this transaction, it generates a new token. So it's always changing. For Apple, they've also started introducing the ability to put other types of cards in that wallet. I've got my Cineplex movie card in there, for example. Boarding cards can go in there from your airplane tickets. But now they're trying to expand that essentially into these other things. So in the future, smart locks will be able to unlock your front door with your Apple Wallet, essentially. They even talked about using this for buildings at work. You know how most people have those little cards that they have to scan to mm-hmm. get in mm-hmm. To the office? They're going to be able to put that into the Apple Wallet as well. So, Apple is launching this, but I think we'll start seeing this with other companies like Google as well.
So just as I kind of understand this in regards to it being a key for a home or for a car key, that's going to involve, I imagine, some kind of fingerprint, a PIN, a scanning. There's got to be multiple security steps here, right? So no one's going to jack my phone and then jack my life and become Dave Brown.
No, that'll be very difficult. There's only one Dave Brown. But yes, it's in your phone. And however your phone is locked, whether that's a PIN code, or you've done, Face ID with an Apple iPhone or fingerprint scan, that is the only way to make that transaction or that connection. Plus, whatever device that you're unlocking also has to support that as well. What's interesting, though, is that some state governments are going to allow people to have their state IDs digitally in the Apple Wallet, which is kind of cool. So one day in the future, you might not have to carry your driver's license around physically anymore. It could be in your Apple Wallet.
Everyone's just going to be scanning and fingerprinting and all that stuff.
Don't lose your phone.
Do not lose your phone. But Mike, that ID side of it is, I imagine, a little bit controversial, right? Because there's one, just a general issue of access to IDs, generally speaking, for a lot of marginalized communities. And then if you add the phone component to say, well, now you must have a smartphone to carry an ID, things could start to get a little murky there, couldn't they?
Yeah, it's interesting. When I look around the world, even in the poorest countries, for example, everyone's got a phone. It's basically, a lifeline to be connected in the world. Like if you don't have a phone, you can't even pay. When I was over in Africa, everyone pays using their little flip phones, through things like M-Pay. So it might not be as a big a problem as, we might think for poor countries and marginalized people as well.
Well, very good. Nice to know that there's going to be more and more stuff to do with my phone, but I still like to carry around straight cash, Mike. I'm still a cash man. Every now and then I surprise the folks at Starbucks by handing them a $5 bill and I'm like, yeah, cash. And they look at me like I'm a caveman.
That's how Dave Brown rolls.
That's a straight cash, homie. Mike, always fun catching up with you. Have yourself a great day, and we'll talk to you again next week.
Bye.
That's Mike Agarbo. He's the host of The App Show, which you can hear Saturdays at 4 p.m. Eastern Time on AMI Audio. And you can follow Mike on Twitter at Mike Agarbo, M-I-K-E-A-G-E-R-B-O. Coming up after the break, we'll catch up with our veteran political correspondent, Craig Oliver. We'll discuss what's going on with the Green Party in Canada. We'll look abroad and recap what happened at NATO and the G7 summits over in Europe. And we'll talk a little bit about what's going on south of the border with former U.S. President Donald Trump, embroiled in some controversy in regards to taking some metadata from political opponents. It's a story that's flown a little bit under the radar. So we'll get Craig's quick take on that one as well. This is Now with Dave Brown on AMI. Welcome back. It's Now with Dave Brown on AMI. The leadership of the Green Party's Annamie Paul is safe for now after party press decided late Tuesday not to kickstart a process that could have ultimately led to her being ousted as leader of the party. Paul was on the verge of a leadership review much sooner than she expected as the party grapples with the departure of one of its only three MPs. MP Jenica Atwin crossed the aisle last week to join the Liberal Party. The infighting began inside the party after a foreign policy schism on the issue of Israel's treatment of the Palestinian people. For his perspective on this, we are joined by veteran and political correspondent Craig Oliver, who joins us from Ottawa. Hey, good morning, Craig.
Good morning, Dave.
So, Craig, Annamie Paul has only been leader for a few months. How damaging?
10 months.
Yeah, exactly. How damaging is this rift to the party brand? Can they afford to be seen publicly bickering like this?
No, they can't. They are at a dead end, which perhaps they can get themselves out of, but I doubt it's going to be with her. Now, let me tell you the latest on this. There was a meeting of the senior executive, the elected executive of the party, last night, and they've presented their leader with an ultimatum. First, she has to publicly repudiate the assistant of hers who went on public and described the young woman who abandoned the party for the Liberals, suggested that she was perhaps racist and anti-Semitic, and that so were many other members of the Green Party. That was pretty rough stuff. And then Paul herself kind of played that tune. And as you know, everybody said she was going to be a breath of fresh air. They were proud of the fact that a Canadian National Party would be run by a Black person and also a woman who's also Jewish. All of these things were considered good. But wouldn't you know, they fell out over Mideast policy. That's not what the Green Party is supposed to do. They're supposed to be doing climate, Dave.
Mm.
And the party has told her, get back to climate, repudiate your assistant, tell us, start listening to the party, or you're out of there. We will. So there's still a chance, I think a very big chance, that they will call a party meeting and oust her as leader.
Craig, what we also saw yesterday was former leader Elizabeth May, who'd been at the helm of that party for well over 10 years, really admonishing Annamie Paul. That's got to be a big impact to the infighting as well, when someone who was seen as such a stable source of leadership for all those years is now picking sides in this infighting.
Yeah, I think Annamie Paul didn't realize what it is anymore to be a party leader. You don't dictate policy to your party anymore, no matter who you are. I think that's what she was expecting to do when she sort of suggested that the problem with Israel was the Palestinians, and the problem was really the Palestinians, that isn't the way many people in the party want to see it. Mm. I mean, what any party leader does in these circumstances is that they say, on the one hand this, on the other hand that. You know that old
right,
game.
Right.
And that's what she should have done. But she decided she was going to be courageous and tell it as she thinks it is, which is that Israel deserves a right to defend itself. And that's it. And that's the problem.
Let's talk a bit further about MP Jenica Atwin from New Brunswick, who did cross the aisle last week to join the Liberal Party in the midst of this infighting. Craig, here comes common man Dave Brown asking you a question. Mm-hmm. When a party member crosses the aisle, should there be an immediate by-election?
That has been talked about many, many times when people leave political parties for another party, which up to then they have been opponents of. I think it's a good idea, but nobody has ever really gotten around to making this possible in any official way. It never gets followed through, really. So I think Atwin is going to have a very hard time winning this this New Brunswick seat. It was kind of a one-off. It was a dramatic victory, gave the party a chance to look like they were really turning into something in terms of being a party coast to coast. So now they've lost her. They've lost, basically, Dave, 30% of the party is caucus in Parliament is gone. That's what's really upset the party establishment. They felt they were on their way to achieving something, and they feel badly let down by this present leader, who my guess is going to find it very hard to repudiate what she believes.
Mm-hmm. Craig, let's jump over to an issue that we've touched on a number of times over the last few months, and military misconduct continues to be in the news again on multiple fronts. Let's begin with Major General Danny Fortin is suing to be reinstated in his position at the top of Canada's vaccine rollout program. Fortin is alleging that politicians interfered to have him removed amidst allegations of sexual misconduct. Meanwhile, Lieutenant General Mike Rouleau is leaving his position as vice chief of the defense staff immediately after being spotted playing golf with General Jonathan Vance, who is currently under investigation for sexual misconduct. Now, in Rouleau's former role, he did have authority over military investigations. Craig, I don't even know what to ask you here other than, have you ever seen such a mess?
Well, first, can you imagine how NATO leaders, when Trudeau met with them, yesterday was it, how they were thinking about the Canadian military? I mean, they were asking themselves, who are these guys? Mm-hmm. What's the matter with these guys? Don't they get lessons in ethics? Don't they get lessons in being officers and gentlemen? Furthermore, if this is where they're at ethically, are they really, and were they ever, in a position to be handing orders out to subordinates who weren't women? We know what they were telling subordinate women. What kind of leadership were they providing the kind of military that they had? And what does this mean, once again, about the Minister of Defense, Sajjan? Why didn't he know anything about this vast story? Hundreds of women complaining about their treatment by especially senior officers in the forces, and nothing ever happened. Nothing was said. Nothing was learned from everything we can find out.
Craig, there's no doubt that political leaders do have to bear some responsibility here. But when you hear about poor judgment like this, doesn't it just scream about that terrible culture within the upper ranks of the military? Particularly in the case of Fortin, doesn't that necessitate the prime minister and cabinet ministers stepping in if the military brass is not acting to deal with what appears to be a serious systemic issue?
Well, Fortin may have a case. Apparently, his lawyer says the lawyer knows that Trudeau himself got involved in this decision to oust him as the person who was in charge of the rollout in Ontario of vaccines. So it does sound, and that would also, of course, have to include the Minister of Defense. And that was breaking the chain of command because as a serving soldier still in uniform, he shouldn't be fired by a politician. He should be fired by the chief of defense staff, whoever that is right now. But for Rouleau, I think that was the biggest unethical move of all. I mean, he was meeting with Vance, who his security people and his police are investigating. Now, how do you possibly do that? What tells you that this was acceptable and above board? It staggers me that we had people with such a lack of what is appropriate and what is ethical that they didn't understand that when he decided to get together with a person who his own police force is investigating actively.
Vance. Absolutely. Yeah, Craig, you and I know that people can say that a golf game is just a golf game, but a golf game is never just a golf game. You chat about everything when you're walking down the links.
And then there are always drinks in the clubhouse.
That too. Well, the patio these days with COVID restrictions.
All right, the patio. Sorry.
Craig, let's look abroad here. The Prime Minister has been abroad for a few days at the G7 and NATO summits. At the G7, a deal was struck to provide 1 billion vaccines to the developing world. Let's hear from British Prime Minister Boris Johnson as he made the announcement at the conclusion of the summit.
I'm very pleased to announce that this weekend leaders have pledged over 1 billion doses, either directly or through funding to COVAX. That includes 100 million from the UK to the world's poorest countries, which is another big step towards vaccinating the world.
Craig, there's a lot to get to at these summits, but let's start with the vaccine deal. What stands out to you about this vaccine deal?
Well, I think it's honorable. I think it's what they have to do, actually. As they say, until you have the whole world clear of the worst of the disease, nobody is. They get on airplanes infected, they infect people wherever they get off the planes, and you're into the whole thing all over again. I think this is a very good number, but they're probably going to have to go farther than that. Canada made a generous offer, put it on the table there. But we simply will not be able to restore our economies. In one sense, we're looking after ourselves. This is very selfish because we cannot have any chance of restoring our economies as major wealthy nations unless we get the third world looked after and unless we are able to prevent them collapsing.
Mm-hmm.
If they collapse, We're going to have to deal with it.
Craig, foreign affairs came up at both summits as well, specifically China and Russia garnering harsh words in final communiques. I've got some sound here from U.S. President Joe Biden as he made his entrance at the NATO summit in Brussels, aiming to consult European allies in efforts about China and Russia. Biden says the threats posed by Russia and China are ones that need to be addressed.
And I think that there is a growing recognition over the last couple of years that we have new challenges. And we have Russia that is not acting in a way that is consistent with what we had hoped, and as well as China.
And of course, President Biden is meeting with President Putin today in Geneva. But Craig, before we jump into more of what Joe Biden is aiming to achieve with these international visits, what do you make of the tone that was set in regards to China and Russia at both the NATO and G7 summits?
I think the other European countries are not really quite as enthusiastic about the China agenda, although they're getting there, as the Americans are. Remember, Biden is there trying to reestablish the American leadership of the G7. And I think he went a long way to do that. They broke up the meeting, they ended the meeting with a good communique, but they did warn that China was a threat to the security of the West, not just militarily, although that's important. They are a fast-growing, very large military now, competing with the US pretty soon, but also technologically and on the global economy. That's the difference with the old Cold War with Russia. Russia was an incompetent country economically. Communist economics don't work, and they never did and never will. And so this time, China is a capitalist country. So we are now in a global struggle for leadership with a country which is just as capitalist as America is, although a little bit more of a command economy. But what the Americans wanted and what NATO needs and the G7 needs is for the Chinese to play by the rules, which they consistently refuse to do. Now, even as we speak, the president of Russia, Putin, is meeting with the U.S. president. And that is probably the most important thing that will come out of this 2 days. The president says he's going to lay down red markers, red lines for the Russian leader, who is crowding America all over the place, who is running operations to undermine the U.S. economy, hacking them, and doing it for ransom. All of this is very damaging. He's going to be told to stop it, or we will begin a large-scale retaliation of our own, that is, the United States will. But also, I think they need to have at least some understanding of where the two of them are at and where their countries are at. Mm-hmm. Where is Russia going? The Europeans are very, very worried about Russia, especially those in Eastern Europe. They wanted Ukraine to be able to go into NATO. Now, this is really interesting, that the president said, no, the NATO is not ready to turn the Ukraine into a NATO nation, because that would mean having to defend them if they're attacked by Russia. But mm-hmm. it would also mean that Ukraine would have to get rid of becoming one of the most corrupt countries in the world, as well as one of a very badly managed country. They have to clean up their act before they would ever be given NATO membership.
Craig, you made a mention right off the top of that last answer that part of what Joe Biden is trying to accomplish here is restoring some of America's international reputation, specifically in NATO, after what were a tumultuous couple of years with Donald Trump at the helm. Can a few days abroad repair some of the damage that America's reputation took over the course of the last few years?
I think it did repair a lot of it that Trump had left behind, where he disparaged NATO, denigrated NATO, denigrated our prime minister. Trump just did in 4 years a decade of damage to NATO. Instead, we now have a new kind of charter, Atlantic Charter, that could be very valuable. I think the big difference now, though, is that China is really regarded as a threat, and a threat to NATO and a threat to Western nation security, or at least democratic nation security. That's new. And that's what came out of this G7 meeting, which was so important, and the NATO meeting that followed. But we know we have to deal with China. We know we have to have a relationship with China. And that's what has to be worked out now between the American president and the Chinese leader. Mm-hmm. I think once again, we're seeing NATO and we're seeing the G7 led by the United States. But there's one big difference. The European countries were badly burned by Trump. And they're saying, well, Mr. President, great to have you here. Next time there's an American election, will we get Trump back? Will we get somebody else like Trump? We have to be careful. So the Europeans are kind of being much more cautious this time while they're supporting the American-led NATO and an American-led G7.
So speaking of the former president, you and I have not talked about him a lot since the inauguration of President Biden, but former U.S. President Trump does find himself in some controversy. And this dropped on late Friday. The Justice Department's internal watchdog launched an investigation after revelations that Trump's administration secretly seized phone data from at least two House Democrats as part of a leaks probe. Democrats are calling the seizure harrowing and an abuse of power. Some politicians are even saying this is worse than Watergate. Craig, you were around for the Watergate scandals. What's your take on this assertion that this move by Donald Trump and his Justice Department was worse than Watergate?
Well, Nixon designed because he broke the law. Trump was breaking the law all the time, breaking all of the rules also. I think that anything Trump was going to do was far worse than anything Nixon did. But he did get impeached twice, remember, mm-hmm, except the Senate mm-hmm. wouldn't fall through and kick him out. So I think what's really noticeable here, and what's really scary too, is that he was willing to use undemocratic methods, fascist methods, to get rid of his opponents if he could. And because this is what the man he admires so much, the Russian dictator, Mr. Putin, does. And this is what other dictators around the world do. And that's where Trump's instincts are. And this is giving you an idea of where America might have gone had the Democrats not won this election. That's what's scary the most. It's what might have happened and what, by the way, could happen again.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Craig, we always appreciate catching up with you on these Wednesday sessions. Thank you for sharing your time with us and your perspective. We'll talk to you again next week.
I like talking to you anytime, Dave. Bye for now.
That sentiment is shared. That's Craig Oliver. He's our veteran political correspondent, and he joined us this morning from Ottawa, Ontario. Coming up after the break, we'll find out what's going on in the world of entertainment with Daniel Penamondo. Daniel's also monitoring social media for us. Mike Ross will be here for this day in history, the now of then. No Ramya Amuthan today, but I've got the information on Kelly & Company in my hands right now, so I'll share that with you as well. This is Now with Dave Brown on AMI. Welcome back. It's Now with Dave Brown on AMI. Ramya Amuthan taking a much-deserved day off today, but the gang at Kelly & Company still hitting the airwaves at 2 p.m. Eastern Time on AMI Audio. So first and foremost, Danielle McLaughlin going to be sitting in the co-host chair. Always fantastic when Danielle's in. So Danielle and Kelly are going to be chatting with Greg David. He's going to be talking about some of the new and returning Canadian and U.S. TV shows. AMI's Ryan Delahanty is going to describe a demonstration that took place during National Accessibility Week that will make a big impact in PEI. And Mary Mammoliti is going to be discussing the latest edition of Kitchen Confession and bringing you the ultimate Father's Day foodie guide. Oh my gosh, Father's Day is this weekend. I wonder what I'm going to get my dad. Can you mail scotch? See if I can mail my dad some scotch this weekend. I think he'll like that. Let's bring in Daniel Panamondo. It's time for an entertainment report. Daniel, what's going on in the world of entertainment today?
Well, I did an entertainment report recently. We talked all about Jack Black, and the question was brought up.
Like, what's he done recently?
What's he done recently, and what's coming down the pipeline? Well, I have an answer for you, because Jack Black and Ice Cube, they're both uniting for the Sony comedy called Oh Hell No. Black is in talks to start with Ice Cube in the project that follows the relationship of Sherman, that's Jack Black, and Will, Ice Cube, after Sherman falls in love with Will's mom. I don't know. It's coming down the pipeline. Crazy premise. There they both are in their younger years.
In all their younger glory years.
Jack Black was last seen in theaters with Jumanji The Next Level and is set for the highly anticipated Borderlands feature adaptation, which is another video game adaptation. It's a popular video. You heard of Borderlands?
I mean, I've heard the name. I don't know anything about the game. But there you go, Jack Black. See, we were asking, like, has he done anything high profile? And you were like, Jumanji. I'm like, a real movie, Daniel. Yeah. And now, like, oh, Borderlands.
Well, I mean, who knows? It's a video game adaptation. We all know. We've seen this movie before, literally.
Flop, flop, flop.
I think Sonic might be one of the like better received video game adaptations, the most recent one. After all the backlash that I got from the first initial reveal in the trailer and the look that people were just clowning on Sonic and how he looked, it actually did quite well and people actually were pretty hot on it. So we'll see if Borderlands is any good. I have no idea. It's not really known for its story, which is interesting. It's like a really fun like looter shooter. So I'm interested in seeing what they do with the story itself. Let's move on to another story here. I got two for you. Disney Plus has officially ordered a Beauty and the Beast prequel series.
Oh my gosh.
Centered on Gaston and Lafeu. A spinoff featuring the devilish duo has been buzzed about since the tale as old as time received a 2017 live action adaptation. Ugh. During the press circuit, both Luke Evans and Josh Gad openly spoke about the desire to revisit their characters and explore how they teamed up in the first place. And over a year later, since those talks in 2020, the streaming service has officially ordered the entire series. Here we go. Can't muster up anything.
No, man, I can't. Look, I can't fight this anymore. Right? I've said that when we're talking about reboots and sequels and prequels, okay, there's room for some wiggle room with intellectual property, mm-hmm. but never once when I was watching Beauty and the Beast as a child, never once when I saw the live action reboot in 2017, did I say to myself, I need more Gaston. If I don't have more Gaston, what am I going to do with my life? It's kind of like this Cruella. Prequel that they put out with Emma Stone, which by all accounts is fairly stylish and a little bit of fun, but a lot of people are like, this is one of the most hated characters in Disney history. Why are we trying to soften her edge?
Yeah, I don't know. It's a good question, and it's obviously not for you. You're not interested in this kind of thing, but I mean,
write new stories.
I mean, they're writing new stories for Gaston and Lafeu. Not entirely original, but it's in that universe. So I think like when you just have the catalog of IP that Disney has, I think you just like you just have to go and, like, this is what I think they feel. They have to go explore the other characters that haven't been explored, whether that's in the original classics, the animated ones, or the live action ones that have all been kind of cropping up recently. So I don't know. This is what they're doing. Obviously not for you, but we'll see what kind of attention this
It's going to get tons. It's going to get tons because Disney's going to put the marketing machine behind it. Everybody's going to love it. And they're going to offer up somebody to be interviewed on Now with Dave Brown. I'm going to be like, oh, tell me about your project. I'm so excited to speak to you. But like, come on now.
I don't know. That's okay. Well, I mean, how many people are there on the planet?
Like seven billion.
7 billion. Well, they have, I mean, you're not watching it, but maybe the 6 billion and you know, all the rest of it.
Dave, it's not always about you. You're not the center of the universe.
But it's okay. I like bringing it up, partly because I'm interested in your take. And I mean, I half know that you're not going to be for it, but I just kind of like seeing you seeing you squirm a little bit with all these like remakes and spinoffs and all that. So anyway.
I just said earlier in the show today, I watched such an original, interesting movie last night, Sorry to Bother You, that was like incredible. And I'm like, I was humming after watching it because I was like, oh, that was so cool. That was so neat. That was so different. That was so creative. And then I come in today and it's like, yeah, we're just gonna borrow some intellectual property from Beauty and the Beast.
I think you have to take a closer look at the numbers, and I would be so interested to hear like what they are for all these new properties that come out. I remember hearing a story. Remember the movie Ad Astra? It was a Brad Pitt like space epic.
Yeah,
it kind of just came and went. It, I don't think it did quite well. Like there are numerous stories of original exciting movies and TV shows coming out, but I guess if the numbers aren't there to back it up, like I guess they're, you know, the companies, the production studios, the studio heads are like backed into a corner. Like, we tried to give you original, no one showed up.
So here's Baby Yoda. So here's
Gaston and here's LeFou on their wild wacky adventure. So we know you're gonna show up based on, you know, just the IP alone, probably, most likely. So this is what you're being fed, because that's where, you know, that's where the sheep and the cattle are going to eat.
There you go. Our first ever sheep reference on Now with Dave Brown. I love it. Daniel, stay right there because you're also filling in for Nazreen Abdel-Majid to tell us what's trending. We've only got about 30 seconds here, Dano, so what you got?
Okay, so really quick, Tupac, he would have been 50 today. So a lot of people paying their respects to Tupac, and rightly so. It's been 25 years since his passing. So a lot of people talking about that. And next up, it also happened again. We talked about the Coca-Cola bottles with the Euros and Ronaldo. But it happened again with player Paul Pogba, who plays for France, who won yesterday. There was a Heineken bottle in front of him, as you can see there. It's a screenshot from the video. And again, those two Coca-Cola bottles on the left. But he took, I mean, he's Muslim, so he doesn't drink alcohol. So, you know, he took the Heineken bottle and put it, you know, underneath him. And it happened again. Another kind of sponsor of the Euro tournament kind of, you know, getting that treatment in terms of these press conferences. Mm-hmm. So people talking about that, too.
Awesome. Thanks, Dan.
You're welcome, Dave.
That's Daniel Panamondo with What's Trending. Let's bring in Mike Ross to wrap up the show with This Day in History, the Now of Then.
June 16th, 1903. Dave, the Ford Motor Company was incorporated. On this day in 1981, Ken Taylor, Canada's former ambassador to Iran, became the first non-American to be awarded the U.S. Congressional Gold Medal. He received the medal from Ronald Reagan, the president, for sheltering and engineering the escape of six Americans from Iran in 1980 during the hostage crisis. And on this day in 1998, the American Film Institute announced its choices for the top 100 films of the first century of cinematic history. The top five in order were Citizen Kane, Casablanca, The Godfather, Gone with the Wind, and Lawrence of Arabia. And those are your events and happenings this day in history.
That would be a pretty good playlist to walk through on a weekend of movie watching during the pandemic. A couple all-time classics right there. Hey, Mike, thank you for this.
You got it, Dave.
That's Mike Ross with This Day in History, the Now of Then. I'm Dave Brown, and you're you, and we are fresh out of time for the show today. Thank you for making time to be with us, wherever you may be, however you listened or watched. We're super appreciative. And we'll be back again tomorrow at 9 a.m. Eastern Time on AMI Audio, AMI TV, AMI.ca, via the AMI Audio Podcast Network, or maybe you've got another way of experiencing the show. I'm genuinely curious to know how you do that. Until then, I'm Dave Brown. I'm Dave Brown? Say your name properly. I'm Dave Brown, reminding you to play safe, play fair, but don't forget to have some fun.
This was an AMI podcast. For more accessible media, visit AMI.ca.